Welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick, and today we're doing our CISSP, and specifically, we're going to be looking at security model concepts. So we've got a few different models that we want to go over, and here to help us with that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How you doing, Adam?
I'm good. Did everybody bring their Lego with them? If you're not, if you don't have it, you're going to have to go out and buy a set. We're talking about models and how to build stuff. So, you know, we're not that far off, actually, right? So it's not going to be quite that, but it's going to be something similar. What we're going to do is talk about the fundamental concepts of security models. And in order to start that conversation, we've actually got to talk about some of the building blocks and components that make up a system before we can talk about the entire model of what that system will be. And so when we think about common system components, we think often about memory, think about CPU, we think about networking, we think about storage. You know, these are the common building blocks of any modern computing system. So let's start with memory. Let's talk a bit about common system components and memory and processing and what processors do, what memory does. We know memory is where we store things, right? So when we have RAM inside of a system, we have random access memory that's dynamic. It's powered, and based on it being powered, it stores things for the time the power is applied. We have ROM, read-only memory, that is going to be considered to be static, meaning whether or not there is power applied to that particular memory chip, it will store certain information in it. That information typically is not modified unless we use a special program of some kind, some sort of updating program, like maybe a firmware updater, or some sort of program that can burn in and actually write to the ROM chip. So we have different kinds of memory. Same thing with processors, right? We have CPUs, generically we call them that. Central processing unit is what CPU stands for. And the idea behind a processor is effectively thinking about it being the brains of the computer. It's where the actual execution of activity takes place. Memory is where we hold that information when we are actually using it. But the actual execution of process to generate data, to manipulate data, to work with it, to change it, to modify it in some way, takes place through the actual CPU or processor or processors, if there's more than one, physical or logical, within the system. And so when we think about common system components and we think about processing and processors, we think typically about four main tasks that processors engage in. They fetch, they retrieve information from memory. So the fetching capability is the processor getting something from memory and then effectively using it somewhere else, right? We talk about decoding, deciphering to understand what something has a meaning to represent or something that has to be done. So we will decode an instruction to effectively decipher it to understand what has to happen with it, because that instruction is typically presented in some sort of a language, whether it's machine language or another kind of programming language, and the system has to effectively translate that into a process that it understands, a language that it can carry out. We talk about executing, carrying out instructions. When I execute something, I'm effectively carrying out an activity. So if I ask Mike to give me a piece of information and tell me what time it is right now, Mike, however he would come up with that information, would relay it to me. He would be executing my request, right? He would be effectively providing me with that information. So that's the example that we would think of when we think about executing. It's going out and carrying out some sort of activity. And then storing. We store the results of that execution so that way we can use it and then use it to either drive another fetching, another decoding, another executing, or another some sort of process within the processor itself. So we think about fetching, decoding, executing, and storing. These are the four distinct main tasks or processor capabilities that CPUs or processors have within a system. Want to make sure you know what they are. Want to be able just to explain them briefly. I gave you a sentence or two, a summary of what they do, and having a good working knowledge of that is going to be important for you as you think about preparing, at least with regard to this information anyway, preparing yourself and studying for this particular part of the CISSP body of knowledge. You know, when we think about increasing performance within a system, we're also thinking about ways that the processor itself can be made to work faster, can be made to do more work in less time. We think about multitasking and multi-threading traditionally. Multitasking is the ability to be able to do more than one thing at the same time. So I can, the classic example, right, of walking and chewing gum that we often hear about is an idea behind multitasking or an example of multitasking. When I walk and chew gum, I'm doing two things at the same time. I may not do them well, and you never want to be around me when I'm doing those things because I'm not quite as sure-footed as some people are. But multitasking generically is the idea of doing more than one thing at the same time. Multi-threading A little bit different. People often confuse the two. Multi-threading is the idea of being able to execute multiple threads or process requests to examine and therefore execute information in the CPU at the same time. They could relate to a single process. They could relate to multiple processes. We're not sure what they relate to. We are just using multiple threads or execution requests and carrying them out simultaneously within the CPU. That's what multi-threading is going to represent. So multi-threading is the idea of the processor working on more than one request at the same time, whereas multitasking is the ability for a system to engage in more than one activity at the same time. If you want to just think about the logic of summarizing that, Mike's keeping me honest here right off camera. He's looking at me going, all right, you're almost there. You got it. That's right. Just one more word. You're good. So make sure we know the definition and the difference between those two terms, multi-threading and multitasking. Very important as a comparison point for you. In addition to the four key tasks that processors engage in, processors have a lot of key features associated with them. A lot of modern processors are tamper detection or have rather, I meant to say tamper resistant, are tamper resistant and have tamper detection switches built into them so that you can't simply go in and mess around with the instruction sets, the software that actually tells the processor how to work and what to do. So we have built-in security features and capabilities that prevent us from being able to modify those instructions. We also have crypto acceleration capabilities. Many modern processors will have onboard crypto accelerators, little computer chips that can offload cryptographic operations so they can engage in those activities while the CPU focuses on the things CPUs need to do. Processing information, fetching from memory, decoding information, and then storing the results of that for future use. They usually will have some sort of battery backup associated with them. So we'll have a CMOS, right, the BIOS battery, the CMOS battery in the system, so that way we can back up the instructions for the operational components of the system. And we'll also, on the CPU itself, have different levels of cache that we may use to accelerate various things. And we may back those up with a battery backup so that way we can keep and store the information in cache and operate the system in different power states and things like that. We have secure boot capabilities. So we typically will have some sort of BIOS-based password that we can boot up with and securely boot up. This may be something like the BitLocker capability in Windows, for instance, which is how we implement this, where you have a BIOS-based or a low-level initialization of the security-based hardware and software. So that way, when you boot up, you have to provide a boot-on password or a boot-up-on password. Let me try that again. A password on boot. That's what I'm trying to say. Backwards. A password on boot. Stop laughing at me. A password on boot in order to be able to... You try standing up here talking without a script for 30 minutes to get everything right every time.
I like my side of the podium.
I know you do, right? So a password on boot is what I'm trying to say, which is the idea that we would be prompted in effect, right? When the system boots up, goes through its power on self-test, the post goes into the BIOS, starts booting up. We have security software and effectively APIs, plugins, that allow the operating system to interact with the hardware at a low level to provide security capabilities. And we may have antivirus software scanning taking place in the BIOS as well at that level against the CPU and against the hardware as well as the software operating at that level as we initialize the system. So there's lots of different things that are going to go on there. And the processor is a really complicated piece of architecture when you think about it. This hardware that we just take for granted that sits in our system and does all these things that effectively acts as the brain of the computer, it's actually a pretty complicated piece of equipment. And we don't often stop and think about just how complicated it may be. I mentioned we also have storage. And we talked about the idea that we have, you know, either local storage, hard drive. We may have it remote. We may store something in the cloud or may use external storage such as a USB device or something like that. But we also have memory. And people often forget that memory is effectively storage. It's just a very specific and very special kind of storage. We talked about there being dynamic as well as static kinds of memory, RAM and ROM. You should just be familiar with the difference between the two and obviously understand the capabilities of each in the sense that dynamic storage, so RAM-based storage, is going to be wiped out when we power down the system. Whereas ROM-based storage, static-based storage, is not wiped out. The information on a ROM chip will stay there even though the power has been removed from the chip. So we want to just make sure we're aware of that. When we think about memory and storage, we have to think about how we protect data within the system, right? So it's one thing to say it's in RAM and it's dynamic, we power off, it's gone. Well, we know that. We know that if it's in ROM, it's going to be static, so it's stored, it's going to be staying there when the power is removed. So that's all good, but that's not the only thing we have to worry about with memory protection. We have to worry about segmentation, paging, and protection keying. So let's talk about what these concepts are. With segmentation, we effectively are dividing the computer memory into addressable areas, and we are then able to put information into those addressable areas and then use that area to store information. That's pretty straightforward. But what segmentation also gives us is the ability to write to or read from a specific memory space, which allows us then to safely and securely store data while it's being processed in the CPU. And while the CPU is fetching it, pulling it back from memory, it knows exactly where to go to get it. So that way, we don't inadvertently pull information in we don't need, but also don't pull in information that we don't want. And this is obviously going to allow us to manage information as a result of that very effectively. Paging is the idea that we can divide the memory address space into equal-sized blocks called pages, and we store information in those pages. You may think of paging generically as being the paging file or the swap file that we often talk about and refer to when we think about operating systems. And it's the same general concept, in the sense that we are writing data that needs to be in memory into a space on the hard drive in a predefined amount of space to offset the fact we don't have enough room in memory, in RAM, to be able to keep all the data in the memory pages or blocks that have been formed by the system. In other words, if we lose enough access to RAM or to memory because we just use it all up, we have to put that other stuff somewhere else. That's one kind of paging. But that's not necessarily the memory protection paging that we're talking about. What we're talking about with memory protection paging is the idea of being able to divide memory up into equal segmented blocks and then reading and writing to and from those blocks contiguously or perhaps non-contiguously to be able to access data on demand. We also can, we'll talk about something later called address space layout randomization, which allows us to randomly put data into various memory spots or pages so that we scatter data. And as a result of doing that, unless we have the map that tells us where we put the data, it's very hard for us to reconstitute what the data is. And because of that, we are safely storing data, but we're keeping the processes in the system unaware of where it is. So if a rogue process actually starts up and tries to access that data, it doesn't have the memory map. It doesn't know where the data is, and it can't find it, so it can't access the data unless we allow it to. It's just another way we can execute memory protection. It's pretty complicated stuff when you think about it, right?
It is.
And we also have something known as protection keying. Protection keying divides physical memory up into blocks of a particular size. So it's very similar to paging, but the idea is that each of those has an associated numerical value called a protection key. And the idea then is that each process is then going to be given access to a certain amount of memory based on the use of that shared key. That key that effectively gives you access to those memory blocks. And by using protection keying, it's very similar to the idea of using a private key, what we would think of as a symmetric key. And we'll talk more about that in some of our upcoming episodes when we get to cryptography as a discussion topic. We're going to use effectively a private key to access secure memory spaces and only allow the process, the running application or running process that is accessing the memory to have access to that data if they have the key. If they don't have the key, they can't access the data. As a result, again, we keep bad processes, malware, things like that, that may get into the system, from accessing sensitive data stored in real time, dynamically available, because in theory, the logic is that the malware process won't have the key. At least they shouldn't anyway, hopefully, right? So this is called protection keying. These are different memory protection techniques, and we want to make sure we're aware of them and understand how they work, because it is important, as we said, as we begin to talk about thinking about systems and how they are built securely, we have to understand all the moving parts and the processes that go into making them work together and how they can safely exchange information is really what we're talking about in this regard. Address space layout randomization, as I said, ASLR, as I mentioned a moment ago, the idea of randomly scattering data within the memory map and then keeping track of where we put it so we can pull it back together when we need it, but not giving anybody else access to it. In other words, the process that owns the data will scatter it across the memory map, marking where it puts it, but not giving access to any other processes for that data unless they go through and request access and are authorized to do so. Address space layout randomization, called ASLR. It's used in more modern versions of Windows operating systems. So, for instance, in Windows 2008, in 2012, in 2016, Server 2016, we use ASLR among other protection mechanisms. We also want to think about storage. We talked about RAM as being a kind of storage, but we also have secondary storage. I mentioned cache or memory caches. That's C-A-C-H, or cache, as some people often refer to it. But the cache, or memory cache, is going to be an onboard, typically on the processor, small area of memory that is used to store instructions that are being used constantly and are being in the middle of being processed and are in transition, if you will. We store information we need on a regular basis there so we can pull it back in very quickly. Fetching from the cache, in other words, is quicker than fetching from another area of the system. And so we use it as just kind of scrap memory areas where we can store things that are constantly in flux. That's what the processor uses it for. So it holds data not currently being used by the CPU, but is going to be needed at some point. And we can store various levels of information in different levels of cache. There may be a level one or a level one and level two or a level one, level two and level three cache built into your system. So it really just depends on the chip architecture, right? So you could think about those things and obviously how that will work. We may also have what's known as virtual memory, right? Virtual memory is often referred to as either paging or swapping. We mentioned that just a couple of minutes ago. The idea of paging or swapping is the idea of being able to use the hard drive to be able to offset the lack of space in the actual RAM. If we run out of room in memory, we got to put stuff somewhere, we write it to the hard drive, and then pull it back. So sometimes this is referred to as virtual memory. This is done by using secondary storage and effectively writing data to a secondary storage device, typically a local hard drive. That's more often than not where we put that. So when you hear virtual memory, we're really thinking about paging or swapping. That's what it's often referred to as. We also think about firmware, which, as I mentioned, is ROM, or at least one type of ROM anyway, which are the instructions or the operations to either use a piece of hardware or perhaps a function within the system that requires access to hardware, has to access the firmware in order to operate. Firmware is just operating instructions. That's generically what it is. It's typically going to be sitting on ROM because it has to be there all the time, whether there's power on the system or not. Imagine the problem we would have if we put our firmware into RAM, and in order to access the hardware, you had to power on to read the access instructions. But in order to do that, you had to be able to see the access instructions to power on. This would be a bit of a catch-22, if you will. Not to physically apply power to the system, that's easy. But to initialize the system when power hits the circuits is what we're talking about. And the instructions to do that are what firmware represents. And so it has to be stored in read-only memory so that we can gain access to it, even though there's not power applied to the system initially. And as power comes on, we're able to then automatically read that information, read it into the memory of the system, and then start operating against it in order to configure the hardware and whatever needs to happen as a result to that. So that is called firmware. Generically, you often think of that as the BIOS in your computer. It's more than that because there could be firmware associated with certain types of hardware as well. But generically, you often think of the firmware as being the BIOS. That's what people often will say. They're kind of interchangeable in that respect. And then we have to think about adding an operating system on top of all this hardware that's chugging away under the hood. We got to install some sort of software that lets us interact with it. Because if all we do is go through the POST, the power on self test, booting up a system with no operating system in it, we don't get very far, right? You basically get a warning on the screen that about 10 or 15 seconds in says, sorry, no operating system present, right? Hit Control-Alt-Delete or F1 or whatever the keystroke is to reboot, but we really can't show you anything else because there's no information, no operating system instructions that tell us how to effectively get beyond the POST. So this is something else we want to consider and think about. So operating systems have to be added into the mix as well. We also have in the operating system something known as the system kernel. The system kernel is effectively going to be the core functionality of the operating system. You know, Windows today is probably made up of several million lines of code. We yearn for the days back in DOS where I could say it was several lines of code because there wasn't much more to it than that. But it certainly was only a few hundred or maybe a thousand or more. It certainly wasn't more than that early on. You know, we've grown exponentially in terms of the size and complexity of the operating systems we use today. But the system kernel has always been a concept that's been there. It's been the secure center, the absolute bare minimum core requirements that are necessary to run that OS and secure the instructions to do so. And that's what the system kernel represents. So what the system kernel does is several things. It loads and runs the binary program. It ultimately schedules task swapping. So it loads and runs the core underlying function that creates the OS itself, schedules task swapping, allocates memory, and ultimately tracks physical location of files on the hard drive. These are the four things that the system kernel is responsible for doing. One more time, just so we know what they are. Loads and runs binary programs, schedules task swapping, allocates memory, and tracks physical location of files on the hard drive so we can find them with a graphical file browser of some kind, Windows Explorer, or Internet Explorer, whatever it is, and we can pull those files up when necessary and show you what's in them and where they're located. This is what the system kernel does. How all this comes together, obviously, is the system engineer and architecture design that we talk about, because the engineering about putting all this together and making it work is complicated, and the architecture and the design that drives that is also complicated. But putting them all together allows the operating system to run and to interact with the hardware and to tell the hardware what to do and how to do it and to access the information necessary to carry out requests that are coming from applications, programs, and user requests within the system at any given moment in time. So this is how they all come together in effect and how they work together. When we think about all of this, we often think about architecture. Now, this may be a system architecture, just a very straightforward design for one system. If we add security into the mix, as we often do in our conversations, we may be thinking about a security architecture, overlaying security on top of that and how security becomes part of the system. When we broaden that architecture out to the entire organization, we often think of that as the enterprise. We think about something that I've referred to before, known as the ESA, the Enterprise Security Architecture. This is the architecture for the entire organization from a security standpoint. And so we can have different levels of architecture, different levels of design, different levels of capabilities that we talk about and manage. And at every level, we're adding capabilities, we're adding functionality, we're also adding complexity. We want to be thinking about the fact that an enterprise system or an enterprise security architecture is going to be a lot broader, but also a lot more complicated to figure out how to get right than a security architecture for an individual machine. A security architecture for one machine is a subcomponent of the enterprise security architecture, but it's a very small part of a very big picture. So let's talk practicality here for a minute. Let's talk real world. So what does an ESA sound like? What does it look like? What does it actually entail? Well, it could entail you describing all the services that the business is going to offer to customers. One example and one part of this. So cloud-based services, virtualization, patch management, electronic content management, file and print, email, mobile device support, remote access. I could go on and on, right? These are all things that you would provide and give users of your systems access to use. We forgot VoIP. Put VoIP in there. VoIP would be another big area, big bucket we'd want to have. We want to have networking. We'd want to have storage. We'd want to have security. These are all services that would also go in there. Name resolution, LDAP, right? Some sort of lightweight directory access protocol. All these things would go in there. And so all of those would be parts of the enterprise security architecture. We would have detailed specifications that help us to figure out how to have all those things work together, as well as what the design capabilities of the system should render to. In other words, what should the system do ultimately? And the architecture helps us to establish not just the priorities, but also the offerings, as well as how those things come together to actually implement the system and operate on behalf of the users to provide those capabilities to anybody that wants to use the system. This is all what the enterprise security architecture is about. When we think about the idea of being able to bring all this together, we think about architecture integration. This is kind of the thought process we're talking about. You know, the idea of taking all these moving parts and pieces of the system, the CPU, the memory, the storage, the different kinds of memory, the ability to be able to lay in security on top of all that, and we integrate the architectural components to build a holistic system. This is really what ultimately a security engineer is part of, but really what a system engineer does. Because the security engineer brings the security conversation to the table, but the systems engineer puts that system together. And the two may be one and the same. You may be both a system and security engineer, but they often are different functions. They often are separated from each other. And what we have to think about is the fact that although we know security is important, we may not always build it in every time and focus on it from start to finish, because the people doing the architecture, people doing the design, people doing the integration may not be the same people that understand and do security. This can be a challenge for us. As CISSPs, we're good at security. We may or may not be good at systems design and system engineering. It just may not be something you do. Many CISSPs understand the conceptual ideas we've just talked about, but that doesn't mean they go out and build systems on a regular basis. It means that they create policies that help to manage those systems, probably do that. It means that they actually may be involved in managing the teams that implement those systems, probably do that. They may be involved in drafting not just the policy, but maybe the procedures as well as the controls that are going to be used to audit and make sure that those procedures are being followed properly, probably do elements of that. But again, you may not actually build the system start to finish. It's a highly specialized set of skills. So we want to just be aware of that and be thinking about that as part of the overarching thought process that we talk about with architecture integration. We also want to be thinking about common security services that are going to be provided, right? When we think about security, we think about things, some of them I already mentioned, right? But we think about things like like access control. We think about integrity services. We think about cryptographic services. We think about boundary control. What is the external boundary? What's the internal boundary? Maybe creating a DMZ. It'll be one way to think about boundary control and differentiating between them, right? A DMZ stands for demilitarized zone, by the way. This is the area we create where we exclude the external part of the network from seeing the internal part of the network directly, but rather build a common area that's not quite private, not quite public, and then we allow information to be exchanged inside that area securely and confidentially, typically, but we have firewalls typically on either side of that boundary, so that way we can differentiate and demarcate what is internal and what is external. This is what the DMZ represents, and boundary control is one security service that we may be providing as part of an integrated architecture. We also want to think about security zones, and I mentioned the DMZ as one example of a security zone. Security zones allow us to specify what takes place in that area. Is it highly confidential information? Do we have to process it securely? Or can we let people walk around and see whatever's there because it's just publicly available? We don't worry about it. A security zone is really just that area that we specify certain activity and certain behaviors will or will not be allowed within. This is something else we want to be thinking about and be aware of as well. And we also have certain kinds of frameworks that help us to guide through these architecture discussions. We have guidance, in other words, we can add to the mix and give to the security practitioner, the security professional, the security architect, so that they can figure out how to do these things and learn from the examples that have already gone before them. Things like the Zachman framework. The Zachman framework is one kind of framework that exists out there. It is a framework that allows us to understand how to do security architecture and secure design. There's also SOPSA. SOPSA stands for Sherwood Applied Business Security Architecture Framework. SOPSA is just another framework that exists out there. It's a holistic lifecycle framework for developing security architecture and looking at the different levels of integration that we have to achieve. There are going to be a total of 6 different architectural views in the SOPSA model that are used to represent different elements of the architectural design, and so we can apply that level of detail if we choose to. There's also something known as TOGAF, the Open Group Architecture Framework. TOGAF is a very popular framework as well, again, for security architecture. You can look up any or all of these frameworks simply by going out on the web and reading up about them if you're interested. You would have to have just a general sense of the fact that there are frameworks that exist and can be applied, but I wouldn't spend a huge amount of time trying to understand the intricate details of any of these frameworks if I was you. In this particular area, in this particular discussion element, we really just want to raise awareness overall of the fact that security architecture is made up of various components and parts, and there are handbooks or guidebooks, if you will. Frameworks can fill in this category of knowledge for us to give guidance to us, but they may not be necessarily something you specialize in, and you would not want to spend a huge amount of time getting familiar with them with regards to trying to prepare for the CISSP exam. But knowledge of them would be very helpful and very beneficial. So just be aware of that. There may be something like ITIL. We've talked about ITIL in some of our prior episodes. IT Infrastructure Library. ITIL itself is a customer service, customer-centric framework with regards to how to manage the provisioning of IT services. But it also deals with security aspects of the architecture. And creating a service-oriented architecture is part of how we would create an enterprise security architecture. So ITIL can offer some guidance to us as well. And the 5 stages of ITIL, we've talked about them before, are probably worth mentioning again here quickly. The idea of being able to go in and think about service strategy, service design, service transition, service operation, as well as continual service improvement. These are the 5 areas of the ITIL framework. And as we think about ITIL, we think about the way in which we go from strategy all the way through to inventing and designing that model, that's the design. We think about transitioning, building. We think about operation, so we think about going live. And then we think about constantly envisioning that and revisiting that so we do continual service improvement to make it better, right? And so as a result of that, that's what we're ultimately going to do when we think about ITIL, that whole holistic vision, right? The whole holistic solution is what comes to bear there.
Very good, Adam. That's a great look at, you know, security model concepts. I know we got more to go. We haven't finished. We haven't even come close maybe to getting through all of that, but a great start. You know, we got to look at some of those core components in a system. We talked about system security architecture as well as enterprise security architecture. And then we broke down or we mentioned some of those frameworks that you might be interested in that can help you if you have to get involved in the design process. Great information. Looking forward to the next episode, but for this one, and that's going to have to do it. We are out of time. Remember, if you guys want to attend one of Adam's classes live, make sure you shoot us a message at cadam@itpro.tv. Signing off for now, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.